So open our Bibles to 1 Samuel. We're going to be in chapter 6 tonight. 1 Samuel, starting with verse 1 of chapter 6. We left off last week. The ark has been captured by the Philistines. They were having trouble with it. Every time they would move it to a different city, there would be these various plagues that would break out among the people. Some were dying. And the more fortunate were plagued by what can only be best described as a very, very serious chronic case of hemorrhoids. That was enough to make these guys so miserable that they were crying out for some sort of relief. And so we left off there last week with the end of chapter 5. And so we begin with verse 1 of chapter 6 tonight. Now the ark of the Lord was in the country of the Philistines 7 months. And the Philistines called for the priest and the diviner, saying, "What shall we do with the ark of the Lord? Tell us how we should send it to its place." So 7 months have passed since the last chapter. And no matter where they've taken the ark, the people have been left in utter misery. There have been those that have died. Probably most Bible guys think some sort of a bubonic plague or something of that sort. Question would be, and so they call for their priests and their diviners. Now, we're not talking about Levites. We're not talking about Aaronic priests. These were the pagan Baal worshiper priests. And they called for them to come and tell them what they could do. The question would be, after being in misery for 7 months, abject, utter, unbelievable, inconceivable misery for 7 months, why did they wait so long? Now they decided to do something about it. But you know, that's really a relatively short time for someone to resist God's will, when you think about it. I mean, I know many people that will resist His will a lot longer than that, and they might even be going through much more serious suffering and consequences than what these guys have gone through. And rather than responding to the Lord, rather than turning to Him, they actually blame Him for their circumstances. Some of us hold out for years. So I guess maybe 7 months isn't quite that long. It does seem to me, though, because we're going to read from the text here, they were pretty clear. I mean, I doubt there was a Philistine in Philistia that had any doubt as to who the source of this calamity was. They realized that they had messed with the wrong guy. They may have thought that they had some pretty powerful gods, but they had come to a very inarguable conclusion that the God of the Israelites was not somebody you mess with. You'd think they'd call out to Him, don't you? I mean, you think they would turn to Him for a solution rather than turning to what we could probably most easily describe as the world's ways. You know, the way that they handled their problems in those days. And so they called for their priests and their diviners, and they said, "What are we going to do with this ark?" And they said, "Well, if you send away the ark of the God of Israel, do not send it away empty, but by all means return it to Him with a trespass offering. And then you will be healed, and it will be known to you why His hand is not removed from you." So now even the priests and the diviners of Baal were saying to these guys, "Well, it's that Yahweh. He's the one that's causing all this. You need to send it back and give him something for their trouble. Send them a trespass offering." They even understood that they had sinned against God. That's what they were saying. "We have sinned against Yahweh. We've sinned against the God of the Israelites. And so we need to send some sort of a trespass offering, some sort of a way of making amends with Him. So don't send it back empty." And so they asked Him, "So what kind of trespass offering should we return to Him?" And they answered, they said, 5 golden tumors and 5 golden rats. Now, those of you that have the old King James, it's 5 golden emerods, which we found out last week were hemorrhoids. So you're going to make these 5 golden hemorrhoids and 5 golden rats according to the number of the lords of the Philistines, because there was 5 Philistine cities, and so we're going to have one of those for each one. Now, my New King James translates it rats. From what I was able to understand, it's probably better mice. But this is what led a lot of the commentators to say that that was the bubonic plague, because it was carried by the fleas on the rats. But they didn't know that back then. You know, that was something they didn't find out for several centuries later. So I don't know that these guys made that connection. Not real sure why they were going to include mice or rats in it. But they said, "Send these 5 golden hemorrhoids and 5 golden rats." And it says, and they answered, "Well, 5 golden tumors and 5 golden rats according to the number of the lords of the Philistines. For the same plague was on all of you and on your lords. Therefore, you shall make images of your tumors and images of your rats that ravage the land. And you shall give glory to the God of Israel. Perhaps he will lighten his hand from you and your gods and from your land. So they made up these little, you know, I can picture a golden mouse. I can kind of, you know, I mean, it didn't take a whole lot of imagination to figure out what those things look like. But these other things, I'm not quite sure I know what those look like. You know, I mean, they probably put on a nice little chain, you know, and made a little necklace out of it. You know, probably thought it was something kind of attractive. I don't know. I don't really understand this passage. And it's kind of interesting when you read the commentators, they don't either. You know, they just, I mean, this is what they did. I don't know what they were thinking. I don't know how they thought this was going to appease Yahweh by doing it. But leave it to the world. You know, I mean, this is the way the world handles a spiritual situation. You know, they probably saw this as nipping in the bud. I mean, they thought they were probably just going right for the jugular here, and they were going to get right down to the nitty gritty and take care of the thing. It is typical of the world to take a spiritual situation and try to handle it in some sort of a physical way. And as silly as this sounds, as nonsensical as this sounds, as impossible even as it is to try to connect the dots in the reasoning here, I'm sure that that's how, from heaven's perspective, whenever we try to handle spiritual issues in a physical, material kind of way, when we try to handle something that's vertical by doing something horizontal, it probably looks just as silly. He says in verse 6, then they go and say, why then do you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts? Now, we saw last week how they remembered that story. They knew how God had gone down and hardened the heart of Pharaoh when the children of Israel were held captive there. You realize that was about 400 years before this? I mean, picture the coming of the pilgrims. It was like almost that long ago before this, that this story had happened in Egypt, and yet it was still something that was common knowledge. It was something that these pagans knew very well had taken place. And they said, why would you want to go and continue to harden your hearts the way Pharaoh did and suffered all the plagues that he did? When he did mighty things among them, and did they not let the people go that they might depart? You know, in other words, they tried to fight against God and didn't do him any good. Why are you trying to fight against him? Now, these are the pagan priests that are telling him this. Isn't that wild? Now, therefore, make a new cart and take two milk cows that have never been yoked and hitch the cows to the cart and take their calves home and then away from them. So, in other words, you're going to get a new cart, you know, no used carts. Don't go down to the used cart store. Go down to the brand new dealership, get a new cart, and then we're going to have two brand new cows, never been hitched up to anything before, two milk cows, not oxen, not those that would be normally used for the yoke to pull something with. These would be milk cows that have never been hitched up to anything. And then we're going to take their calves home, kind of lock them up. And then take the ark, this is verse 8, take the ark of the Lord and set it on the cart. And then put the articles of gold which you are returning to him as a trespass offering in a chest by its side. Notice that. They're going to take these golden hemorrhoids and these golden mice and they're going to put them in another box beside the ark of the covenant. These guys knew better than to mess with the ark. They'd learned their lesson with that. They weren't even going to touch it. You would think, well, they would put it inside. But no, they weren't going to touch the thing. Then send it away and let it go. And watch it. If it goes up the road to its own territory, to Beth Shemesh, then he who has done us this great evil. But if not, then we shall know that it's not his hand that struck us. It just happened by chance. And so, you know, we saw last week how they had gone through these different Philistine cities. They'd first taken it to Ashdod when they first captured it. That didn't work, so they took it down to Gath. People started breaking out with all kinds of badness there, and so they sent it on up to Ekron. Ekronites saw it coming, and they just freaked because they had already heard what was happening in Ashdod and Gath. And so for 7 months, all of Philistia has been suffering from the presence of this ark. And so they decided we're going to send it to Beth Shemesh, which was a Levitical city just a few miles east of Ekron, about halfway between Ekron and Jerusalem. And they were going to send it over to them because, you know, that's where the Jews were, and then we can alleviate ourselves of this plague. And the plan was they're going to take this new cart with the milk cows, hook it up to the cart, put the gifts inside another chest beside the ark on the cart, and then send it over to Beth Shemesh. And if the cows go up the road, ignoring their calves, and they go on up the road to a direction that they've never gone before, then we'll know that it's God delivering them. If they turn around and start heading back to the barn so they can be with their calves, then we'll just know that it was coincidence. Of course, we know, those who believe in the sovereignty of God know, that there's no such thing as coincidence. But these guys don't understand the sovereignty of God. And so they're about to find out that chance, as they said here, had nothing to do with it. Verse 10, so the men did so. They took two milk cows and they hitched them to the cart and shut up their calves at home. And then they set the ark of the Lord on the cart and the chest with the gold rats and the images of their tumors. And then the cows headed straight for the road to Beth Shemesh and went along the highway, lowing as they went, and did not turn aside from the right hand or the left. And the lords of the Philistines went after them to the border of Beth Shemesh. So they started up the road, and it says the cows were lowing as they went. And the word that's translated lowing here, it kind of has the idea of they weren't just like mooing. It wasn't a contented kind of a lowing at all. They were hurting. You know, they were milk cows, and their udders were full, and their calves were crying for them, and they would much rather be with their calves and doing what they were made to do. They weren't happy doing this. But they weren't under any kind of human compulsion to do so. They were under divine compulsion. I can imagine if we could translate from cow-ese into English what these lowing cows were saying, they were probably going, those stupid Philistines, you know, don't they understand that God's in charge here? I mean, if they would just bow their knee to Him, we could be home with our babies and taking care of business. But instead, we're going up this road to Beth Shemesh, lowing as we go. And so the Philistines followed them all the way to the border of Beth Shemesh, and then they stopped. Now, in 2 Samuel 6, we see the story where we're going to see where the ark ends up tonight. It's going to stay there for many years until David becomes king. And then David starts moving the ark into Jerusalem, and he uses the very same methods that the Philistines did. Took the ark, put it on a cart, and started moving it in. And when it started to go over a rough place in the road, this guy named Uzzah reached out to steady it to keep it from falling over. God whacked him right there on the spot. Now, these Philistine guys, they didn't have the golden rods that had been, you know, when they first built the ark, they were instructed to take these wooden poles, cover them with gold, and then they were to use those rods to carry the ark. They were never to touch the ark. Nobody ever touched the ark. It was always going to be carried by these poles. Well, the Philistines didn't have those poles. We know that they had to pick the cart up and or the box up to move it around to get it, you know, pick it up off the floor in front of Dagon and take it to the different carts that it was on and different places it would go to. We know that that was the situation. These guys had been handling it, and yet nothing happened to them. God didn't whack them, but He whacked Uzzah. Is that a double standard on God? Is that a duplicitousness on God's part? No, He didn't have a covenant with the Philistines. You know, he didn't have a provision with them. He had the covenant with this covenant that he had was with the Israelites. He wasn't in a covenant relationship with these guys. And so it says in verse 13 that the people of Beth Shemesh were weeping their wheat harvest. So this would have made it in the late spring in the valley. And they lifted their eyes and saw the ark and rejoiced to see it. And then the cart came into the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh and stood there. A large stone was there. So they split the wood of the ark and offered the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord. And the Levites took down the ark of the Lord and the chest that was with it, which were with the articles of gold, and put them in on the large stone. And the men of Beth Shemesh offered burnt offerings and made sacrifices that same day to the Lord. And when the five lords of the Philistines had seen it, they returned to Ekron that same day. So Beth Shemesh was one of the, I think there were 23 Levitical cities that had been established where they were like these provincial areas where the Levites could have farmland, because they didn't, you know, the Levites didn't have an inheritance. They didn't. There was no tribe of Levi that had a parcel of land in the land disbursements. So they were given these cities throughout Israel on both sides of Canaan, or on both sides of the Jordan River, so that they would be dispersed throughout the country. And Beth Shemesh was one of those Levitical cities. So there would have been a bunch of Levites there to really take care of the problem. verse 17 says, these are the golden tumors which the Philistines returned as a trespass offering to the Lord. One for Ashdod, one for Gaza, Ashkelon, Gath, and for Ekron. And the golden rats, according to the number of the cities of the Philistines, belonging to the five lords. Both fortified cities and country villages, even as far as the large stone of Abel, on which they set the ark of the Lord, which stone remains to this day in the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh. And then he struck the men of Beth Shemesh. Check this out. So all's happy, all's good, all's happy. They finally got the ark back. Happy days are here again. And then the very next verse, verse 19, and the Lord struck the men of Beth Shemesh because they looked into the ark of the Lord. And he struck 50,070 men of the people, and the people lamented because the Lord had struck the people with a great, because the Lord had struck the people with a great slaughter. Now, the manuscript evidence, most commentators, most everybody pretty much agrees that this 50,070 is not accurate. The Hebrew could read, he struck 70 out of the 50,000 men. But I don't even know that Beth Shemesh was that large of a city. You know, it was just a small Levitical village. So it's probably some sort of scribal thing. 70 guys died. That would have been a lot. Why did they die? Because they looked inside the box. They opened up the lid and they looked inside. The law was very clear. You don't touch the box. You don't touch it. The Ark of the Covenant was kept inside the inner sanctum of the tabernacle that was known as the Holy of Holies. It was completely enclosed off, a 10-by-10 room that only the high priest, there was only one man in all of Israel that was allowed to go into, and he was only allowed to do it on one day out of the year. And that was only after he had made atonement sacrifices for himself. Then he could go in, and then he could make, he could take the blood of the sacrifice from the scapegoat, or the other sacrifice, before they let the scapegoat go, and he would take the blood in and sprinkle it on the lid of the box, the lid of the Ark of the Covenant, which was called the mercy seat. He wasn't even allowed to touch it. Nobody ever touched it. When it got time to move in the wilderness, they would slide those gold rods through the rings on the side, and they would carry it that way. That was very clear. Everybody understood that. Everybody knew that. That was a fundamental point of Judaism as you could have. And yet these guys decided they would look inside. Now, I know everybody's probably thinking, you know, Harrison Ford-ish thoughts and things like this right now and everything. You know, try to get that, you know, no Indiana Jones thing here, but get that out of your mind. But God said, don't look inside there. Don't touch it. And yet these guys did. Why? Maybe out of curiosity, you know. I mean, none of them had ever seen the ark before. Only one person ever saw it, and that would be the high priest. They'd never seen it before, so here it is. They saw it. Wonder if everything's still there. Wonder if the Philistines left everything it was supposed to be. Maybe we better check and make sure the Ten Commandments are still in there, or that pot of manna, or Aaron's rod. Maybe we better make sure those things are still in there. Those were the three items that were inside the ark. So they took a look. Was it out of curiosity? Making sure everything was still there? I don't know. You know, the fact is, God said not to do it. Why would God be so radical about the outcome of this? I mean, wouldn't just some thundering and lightning have sufficed? Wouldn't that have gotten their attention? You know, these guys looked inside it and all of a sudden, you know, and they would have backed off and they'd say, oh boy, we know better than to do that again. I mean, shouldn't that have been enough? And yet he struck 70 of these guys. If we want to approach God, we must, this isn't just a suggestion, okay? I mean, this is a command. In fact, it's an indelible command. It's something that where there's about 0% wiggle room. If we want to approach God, we must do it on His terms. Now, that might sound kind of fundamental. That might sound kind of foundational, but it's true. There's only one way you can go to God, and that's on His terms. Now, as I said, the Ark of the Covenant was a thing that this was the closest the people could have to redemption under the Old Testament economy. That once a year on the Day of Atonement, the high priest would go in and he would sprinkle the blood of the sacrifice over the lid, which was called the mercy seat. It had these two angels. Remember, there was the two cherubim who were facing each other, and their wings were leaning forward, touching, and the angels were looking down. They were facing forward and then looking down onto the lid, and they would see symbolically, they would see as the high priest would sprinkle the blood on the lid, then they would see that. And in Israel's mind, this was the place where God dwelt. God was there between those two cherubim. He was there at that place where the blood was applied. He would see the blood applied, and the people's sins would be covered over for another year. It wasn't really in literal terminology the place of God's presence, because he's omnipresent, right? It was kind of a symbol of God's presence. A very powerful, very real symbol, but it wasn't like God was there and not here. You know, it was a symbol of God's presence. And for the people to approach God, they had to go through that prescribed manner. With no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Had to be that way. And yet these guys were taking it upon themselves to rationalize, for whatever reason they thought, we got to make sure everything's still okay. Whatever they were thinking, they were rationalizing it, and so they went against God's very prescribed will in order to do it. Now, if that's true, and it is, how much more so for us in the new economy, after Jesus has paid the price for sins, after he has ascended the right hand of the Father, and he said very clearly, with no ambiguity at all, there was no room for interpretation. He said, if anyone's going to come to the Father, he's got to do it through me. There's only one way to the Father, and that's through the Son. If these guys couldn't do it when they were just trying to approach the symbol of God's presence, how do we think, as human beings living in the 21st century, think that we can do it in reality? That we can die and we can go up to heaven and we can just give God our best shot. You know, God and I will have a talk when it's all said and done. When he hears my side of things, then he'll agree that he should let me in. I mean, if these guys would have got whacked as quickly as they did, how much do you think somebody is going to be able to call their own shots in reality, in the real presence of God? Probably not going to go very far. Probably won't wash too well. And the men of Beth Shemesh, verse 20, said, who is able to stand before this holy Lord God? And to whom shall it go? And to whom shall it go up from us? You know, what's kind of wild about it is, as I said, this was the Levitical city. There were a bunch of Levites around there. They didn't know what to do with it. You know, we can kind of understand how the Philistines didn't know how to handle it. It's a little disconcerting that the religious leaders didn't know how to deal with it. And they felt at loss. You know, the bottom line of it is, there's a lot of, sometimes people will come to me with they're wrestling with decisions. They're trying to make some sort of a choice. They got options before them or something. They're wanting to, you know, some prayer and a little bit of guidance. And you know, I mean, most often these people know the Bible as well as I do, and we'll kind of look at what the Bible has to say about it and everything, and I might offer an objective, you know, third party sort of a thing, and I'll pray with them, and then and I really don't know what to tell them. You know, I just said, well, just what do you want to do? I mean, you know, this is a good option, that's a good option. I don't know what God's will is on this. And sometimes we find ourselves in those kind of things where we're having a little trouble trying to see what God's perfect will is, you know, because it just boils down to making a choice. But the reality is, most of our whole life is nothing but a series of choices. We make choices all day long, every day, all of our lives. And most of them are not that, most of the choices we make are not the sort of thing, well, I don't know what God, I mean, you know, God didn't really care what color socks I put on today. I didn't have to spend too much time praying and fasting about that one, you know. And most of the choices that we make at any given time, we know whether we should or we shouldn't. You know, we have this choice, I guess my point is, we have this choice to either do things God's way or not to. Now, sure, we can rationalize not. I mean, these guys were probably pretty good at it. I'm the world's best. I'm the world's best at justifying my actions. I can rationalize anything. But you can't rationalize away God's will. I mean, you can try, but you'll have to deal with the consequences. You know, it's just, we all have this choice. We are faced with a choice every day, whether to do things God's way or not. But we should never make the error of blaming God when it goes south. It's not God's fault that we make choices that are contrary to His will, and then we have to suffer the consequences of it. So they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kirjath-Jearim, saying, "The Philistines have brought back the ark of the Lord. Come down and take it up with you." You know, even this Levitical city didn't want it. They were afraid of the ark. And so the men of Kirjath-Jearim came and took the ark of the Lord and brought it into the house of Abinadab on the hill and consecrated Eleazar, his son, to keep the ark of the Lord. You know, after the last almost a year history of this thing, it'd probably be a little antsy having it in my house. You know, I don't know about you guys, but I'm not quite sure. You know, you'd just be afraid you might have do something wrong. But it was very clear how they should deal with it. You know, it was very clear. There wasn't like this big book of rules and regulations. There was only one rule: don't touch it. You know, it would have been simple enough. And so the ark remained in Kirjath-Jearim for a long time, and it was there for 20 years, and all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. You know, they had the ark. I mean, it had been gone for almost a year now, and they had lamented that. It would appear as though, the Bible doesn't tell us, but my guess is that the tabernacle was destroyed in the battle with the Philistines, because we don't see any mention of the tabernacle during this time. You know, why didn't they just take it back to the Holy of Holies? Presumptively, it didn't exist. So they had the ark back. But they still did, they still lamented the Lord. You know, they had the symbol of God's presence, but they didn't have Him. And so then Samuel spoke to all the house of Israel, saying, "If you return to the Lord with all your hearts, and then put away the foreign gods and the Ashtoreth from among you, and prepare your hearts for the Lord, and serve Him only, then He will deliver you from the land, from the hand of the Philistines." You know, it's kind of like what Elijah said. Remember, when Elijah, this would be a few hundred years later than this time, but when Ahab and Jezebel were ruling in the northern kingdom, and Elijah called all, there was 450 prophets of Baal. He went before the people and he says, "How long will you falter between two opinions?" I'm not sure what the word falter means, but, well, I guess I know what it means. It's never heard, but it's the only place I've ever seen it before. How long are you going to falter between two opinions? If Baal is God, if Baal is God, let's serve Him. I mean, doesn't that make sense? If He's the real deal, let's give in to Him. But if Yahweh is God, let's serve Him. People go, "Well, that sounds like a good idea." And so he called 450 of the prophets of Baal together. They went up on top of Mount Carmel. We know the story, you know, where they had the whole thing where they had the two sacrifices, and the prophets of Baal were trying to call down fire from heaven, and nothing would happen, and they'd cut themselves. And Elijah was just kind of all chill over in the corner, you know, making fun of them and everything. He'd say, "Well, you know, maybe Baal's taking a trip. Maybe he's gone to the bathroom." You know, he's saying all these different things about him, and nothing was doing any good. And so then finally he had him just like saturate his offering and dig a trench around it and fill the trench with water. And then he says, "Okay, God, get them." And this fire came down from heaven and consumed the water, consumed the sacrifice. And then he told the people, he says, "Now you guys get them." And they killed all 450 prophets of Baal. "How long will you falter between two opinions?" Elijah said. That's kind of what Samuel's saying to these guys. You know, ever since I've been on the scene, Sam's saying, you guys have kind of like had one foot here and one foot there. You know, you want to have just enough God to make you secure, but not enough to change your life, kind of a thing. Now, they didn't have HBO and ESPN and golf and computers and video games back then. They didn't have all these other, they didn't have all those important things to take care of their time. So the way, you know, they said, "Look, you know, all right, listen, I'm all about Yahweh. He's fine. He's good. He's, you know, I love Him and I want to serve Him, but He wants me to be happy. He wants me to enjoy life." But they didn't have these other distractions to enjoy life by. They couldn't, you know, sit at home with the clicker and do this. And so the way they enjoyed the pastime in those days was to worship idols. You know, that's what they would do. They would just, that's what the world did. All the world was all about these different idols and stuff. And so the Israelites were kind of doing the same. They weren't anti-God. They were just kind of pro what everybody else was doing, because that's what was hip. That's what was happening. And the way the Bible expresses it is that they were faltering between two opinions. And so he says to them, how long are you going to do that? I said, you know, if God is God, then let's serve him. If he's not, then fine. Let's go play video games and your other pursuits. That's effectively what Samuel is saying to the people. And so the children of Israel put away the Baals and the Ashtoreths and served the Lord only. And Samuel said, gather all Israel to Mizpah, and I will pray to the Lord for you. And they gathered together at Mizpah and drew water and poured it out before the Lord. And they fasted that day and said there, we have sinned against the Lord. And Samuel judged the children of Israel at Mizpah. Now, Mizpah, if you didn't know it, that was a place where Laban and Jacob separated. Remember when Jacob and his family had left in the middle of the night, and Laban pursued him and caught up with him there at Mizpah, and said, "You're taking my grandbabies away from me," and so they ended up having this kind of a powwow, and they agreed that they would go their own separate ways. And so Mizpah, actually, the word means watchtower. That's, they named the place then because they said God's going to watch over you to make sure you keep your end of the bargaining here, and then they said that to each other. But so it speaks of, you know, the name place means watchtower. God is checking this out. God is watching this. But then it also is a place of separation. It's a place where the separation happens, takes place. And so he told all of Israel to gather there. And they're having this time of consecration. They're having this time of separation where they're separating from their Baals and their Ashtoreths. They're separating from all of their idol pursuits, and they're going to serve the Lord only. And then they take this water, they scoop up some water, and they pour it out. Now, the water speaks of two things. It's kind of symbolic of two things. One is it speaks of consecration. You know, there was it's what's called a libation, when you pour out a drink offering before the Lord, and you're pouring it out. You're pouring it all out. You know, you don't just pour some of it. You know, you don't just sprinkle a little of the holy water around. You pour it out. And it speaks of consecration. You're emptying yourself. And it also speaks of irrevocability. Once you've poured it out, you can't get it back. You can't, like, oh, change my mind and get the water back into the jug. You know, once you pour it out, it's gone. It's poured out. And so he gathered all of Israel there at Mizpah, this place of separation, and they had this ceremony, and it was symbolically saying, okay, we're gonna do this. We're gonna separate ourselves from our gods. And then when the Philistines heard that the children of Israel had gathered together at Mizpah, the lords of the Philistines went up against Israel. And when the children of Israel heard of it, they were afraid of the Philistines. So the children of Israel said to Samuel, do not cease to cry out to the Lord our God for us, that he may save us from the hand of the Philistines. Now, I don't know if the Philistines thought that they were gathering together for some sort of a battle. You know, maybe they were mustering their forces, and so that's why they felt, you know, all those Israelites are filling their oats again. We better do something about it. Might have been that. Or it might have been that they were recognizing that they had gotten together for this big church service, and they were thinking kind of like the Arabs did under the Yom Kippur War, where we'll just get them while they're busy worshiping. You know, we'll get them while they're not thinking about battle, and we'll catch them unawares. Might have been that. I'm not sure what their motivation was, but the Philistines gathered to come against the Israelites. And check this out. The Israelites said to Samuel, oh, Sam, go pray to the Lord for us that maybe he would deliver us from the hand of the Philistines. Now, three chapters earlier, back in chapter 4, they said, when they were battling against the Philistines and they thought they were going to lose, they said, go get the Ark of the Covenant and we'll put it out in front of us. Maybe it will save us from the hand of the Philistines. And their faith was in this object, this symbol. Their faith was in something that they had actually made. And, of course, God wasn't going to let that happen. But now they've learned their lesson, and so they said to Samuel, he says, pray that maybe he, the Lord, would deliver us from the Philistines. And Samuel took a suckling lamb and offered it as a whole burnt offering to the Lord. And Samuel cried out to the Lord for Israel, and the Lord answered him. I don't know if you know this or not, but here's a truism. You know, these people have been living kind of a wishy-washy, double-minded, one foot in, one foot on, out, on again, off again, kind of quasi-spiritual existence for decades now. In the very second, the very moment they make a commitment to God, the enemy attacks. It's always going to be that way. I mean, if you don't want to get messed with by Satan, if you don't want him messing with you, then be mediocre. Go the same direction he's going in. It's only when you turn and face him that you're going to face him head on. When you turn around and go the other direction, you go the way God's going, then you're going to face him. The first thing you're going to see is the enemy. He doesn't mess with you when you're not. But as soon as we take a stand for the Lord, then he's immediately there in the picture. And he can be pretty formidable. He can be pretty intimidating, I understand. He can sometimes appear to be very powerful. But he ain't diddly compared to God. And so the Israelites are crying out to Samuel. They're saying, pray for us. Pray on the Lord's behalf that he might come on to our aid. And so, you know, and this speaks so much of Jesus here, where they take this suckling lamb. I mean, it's not even a yearling. It's a little baby lamb. I mean, what could be more of the epitome of innocence and purity than just a little baby lamb? And he offered that as a burnt offering, of course, speaking of the sacrifice that Jesus made. Understanding, you know, you think, well, why did they have to do that? Because they understood that without the shedding of blood, there is no remission of sins. That before they could go to the Lord, the sacrifice had to be made. The blood had to be shed. And as Samuel was offering the burnt offering, the Philistines drew near to battle against Israel, but the Lord thundered with a loud thunder upon the Philistines that day and so confused them that they were overcome before Israel. You know, it's not like God just said, thunder up, baby, you know, wasn't that sort of a thing. But Baal was considered to be the god of the weather, the god of the thunder. And in fact, some of the depictions of him shows a lightning bolt in his hand. And so God says, I'll show you who's the god of thunder, you know. I got your Thor right here, you know, kind of a thing. And so he just like big old loud thunder boomers that just scared the Philistines to death. It confused them. In fact, it says that if you got the old King James, it discomfited them. And I love that word. You know, that's just one of those King James words that I wish we still had today. I don't know what it means, but you know what it means. You know, they were discomfited. That's what they were. They weren't comforted. They were discomfited because the Lord had thundered. And then the men of Israel went out of Mizpah and pursued the Philistines and drove them back as far as below Bethkar. Then Samuel took a stone and he set it up between Mizpah and Shane, and he called its name Eleazar, saying, thus far the Lord has helped us. And as we saw a couple of weeks ago, you know, this was where they lost the ark in the first place. This place called Eleazar means stone of help. Twenty years later. You know, this place, Eleazar, the stone of help. I think we can say that we always come to the stone of help when we do things God's way. It's very easy, it's very natural, it's very normal, and there's tremendous, oftentimes a lot of peer pressure to do things the natural way, to do things how it would come easily, how it would come most readily. But when we stand on God's word and we make the commitment that we're going to do things his way, even when we can't understand how the outcome is going to be, even when we don't know how it's all going to come down, even when it looks like everything should fall apart, that stone of help will always be ours. When we come to the place where instead of trying to get God into our program, we decide to get into his, that's when we find the stone of help. And so the Philistines were subdued, and they did not come anymore into the territory of Israel. And the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel. And the cities which the Philistines had taken from Israel were restored to Israel, from Ekron to Gath. And Israel recovered its territory from the hands of the Philistines. And also there was peace between Israel and the Amorites. And Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life. And he went from year to year in a circuit from Bethel, Gilgal, and Mizpah. and judged Israel in all those places. He was kind of like a circuit judge. You know, they had circuit judges in the Old West. Well, he was a circuit judge in the Old East. And he would go around to these places on a circuit. But he always returned to Ramah, which is modern-day Ramallah, you know, where the Palestinian headquarters is. He would return to Ramah, for his home was there, and there he judged Israel, and there he built an altar to the Lord. Now, several years separate chapters 7 and 8, okay? It says, it came to pass, when Samuel was old, that he made his sons judges over Israel. We don't know that he had the authority to do that. You know, God appointed the judges, and it appears as though this is something Samuel might have taken upon himself. But he made his sons judges of Israel, and the name of the firstborn was Joel, and the name of the second was Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways, and they turned aside after dishonest gain and took bribes and perverted justice. Sound familiar? I mean, doesn't this sound just amazingly close to the story that we saw in the earlier with Eli and his sons? Eli was a pretty good guy, but he had these sons who weren't. I think what's even more salt in the wound is these names, Joel and Abijah. The name Joel means Jehovah is God. That's a pretty cool name. You know, I mean, when he was born, Sam said, we're going to name him Joel. So everybody, every time his name is mentioned, it's a proclamation of who Jehovah is. Yahweh is God. And then Abijah means Yahweh is my father. Jehovah is my father. Two very godly names, you know, and given to them by their father to carry on the legacy. And as they reached adulthood, they were carrying on their own bad selves. I don't know if Samuel failed in the same way that Eli did. You know, Eli was chastised for not doing anything about it. We understand that children make their own choices. I'm not sure if Samuel just kind of learned his fathering from the example that had been given to him by his adopted father, Eli, and continued that cycle. I don't know if that's what was going on here or not. Or what, but his sons certainly went south. It says, then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, look, you're old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations. There was a, you know, having a king was not part of God's plan. It had always been part of God's plan to have a king. He was going to do it, though. And these people are certainly getting ahead of him. In fact, Genesis 4:49-10 says, the scepter shall not depart from Judah. Now, we know that's a promise of the Messiah, but they saw this, you know, the scepter was a sign of the king, and they saw this as a promise that there would be a kingdom one day. And, of course, it was always God's plan that there would be. Numbers 24:7 says, a scepter shall arise out of Israel. And so another promise of a kingdom. In fact, when he was given the second law in Deuteronomy, there's a fairly lengthy passage in Deuteronomy 17, starting with verse 14, says, and when you come to the land which the Lord your God has given you, and you possess it and dwell in it, and you say, I'll set a king over me like all the nations that are around me, then you shall surely set a king over you from whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your brethren you shall set as king over you. And you shall not set a foreigner over you who's not your brother. But he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. For the Lord has said to you, you shall not return that way again. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away. Nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. And also it shall be that when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book, from the one before the priest. So the first thing he was supposed to do as he became king was sit down and write out the law in his own longhand so he couldn't say he was ignorant of it. One before the priest of Levites, and it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God and be careful to observe all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brethren, that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right hand or the left, that he may be that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. So these elders come to Samuel there in Ramah, and they say, look, you're old and your children are messing up. So we want a king. That was their stated reason. The stated reason was twofold. You're old and your sons are no good. The real reason is they wanted to be a kingdom just like all the nations around them. They had this desire for worldliness. They didn't want God to rule over them through the judges. They wanted to look just like their neighbors. They wanted to look just like the world. G. Campbell Morgan says, this is the revelation of the supreme wrong. They had been chosen to be unlike the nations, a people directly governed by God. You know, when God had first chosen, he said, he told Abraham, he said, I'm going to make a nation out of you, and it's going to be different, it's going to be separate, it's going to be a holy nation, a separate, set-apart nation. People are going to look at this is my goal, this is my plan for Israelites. People will look at Israel, and they'll say, oh, that's what a nation looks like who God blesses. When a nation walks in God's ways and he blesses them accordingly, that's what that looks like. And he says all the world will be drawn to them because of that. That was his plan. That was his goal. That's why he did it in the first place. And yet all along, all Israel wanted to do was be just like the world. They didn't want to be separated from the world. They wanted to look just like it. And now the way that would be by having a king. And so it says the thing displeased Samuel. And he said, give us a king. When they said, give us a king to judge us. And so he prayed to the Lord. You know, that's a good idea. When you're displeased with something, when things aren't going your way, go pray to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, heed the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they rejected me, that I should not reign over them. According to all the works that they have done since the day I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Now therefore, heed their voice, however. You shall solemnly forewarn them and show them that the behavior of the king who will reign over them. You know, for those of you that are or have ever been in any kind of a ministry position at all, any kind of a leadership sort of a capacity, even to the degree of just sharing your faith with a loved one, it can be hard not to take it personally when people reject God's will. If you have shared with them God's will and when they reject that, it's hard not to take it personally, because you go through these gyrations of, well, if only I had said this, or if only I had done that, or if I could just, maybe I didn't do it right. And you just wonder if you had been better, then these people's eternal destiny would be somewhat different. But we need to understand they're not rejecting us, though. That's what God said. That's kind of how Samuel was feeling here. And God says, they're not rejecting you, Sam. They're rejecting me. Now I have seen men and women of God use that as an excuse to be obnoxious. You know, they treat people in an obnoxious manner, and then when people reject them because of their obnoxiousness, they say, hey, well, you're not rejecting me, you're rejecting God. You know, that's not what's going on here at all. In God's economy, you know, you hear me say often how totally convinced I am that God is completely sovereign in the universe at all times. A little hard to reconcile, though, when you see how much ungodliness there is, when you see how much that goes on that is contrary to his revealed will. It's hard to see that sovereignty. But I think we need to understand that within this whole panorama of God's will, there's this big balloon that we could call God's permissive will. It's things that are not necessarily his choice, but things that he allows. And that he is going to work in the midst of that rebellion against his will to accomplish his sovereign will in the outcome. And as we as Christians, as we want to grow in the Lord and we want to get closer to him, we want to be more and more like Jesus every day, we want to come to that place where we grow in the Lord. We need to understand that God will not only take us to that next level that we allow him to take us by staying in the center of his perfect will rather than his permissive will. There's a lot that God allows in our lives that are not his revealed will, and just simply because he allows it doesn't mean that it's his will. You know, did the Israelites say they were rejecting God? No, they weren't even thinking in those terms. They just wanted to be like the world. But God said, no, they're not rejecting you, Samuel, they're rejecting me. They were. What he's saying is they're calling their will my will. You know, they want to do it, and so they're saying, no, go get us a king that the Lord will approve of, when the Lord hadn't said to do that. And so Samuel, check this out. Samuel calls the people, and he gives this exhortation to him. He says, he told all the words of the Lord to the people who asked him for a king, and he said, notice how many times he says that he will take. This will be the behavior of the king who shall rule over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots to be his and to be his horsemen, and some will run before his chariots, and he will appoint captains over his thousands and captains over his fifties, and will set some to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and some to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He'll take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers, and he'll take the best of your fields and your vineyards and your olive groves and give them to his servants. He'll take the tenth of your grain and your vintage and give it to his officers and his servants, and he'll take your male servants and your female servants, your finest young men and your donkeys, and put them to his work. And he will take a tenth of your sheep, and you will be his servants. And you will cry out in that day because of the king whom you have chosen for yourselves, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. Six times in this little passage of Samuel's, he says he will take. He will take, 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 he will take. And then he ends it by saying, and you will be his servants. After he's taken everything from you, then you will serve him. And you'll cry out to me and say, oh God, how did you let this happen to us? And I'm not going to hear you. That's what we do, isn't it? We want something, so we couch it in spiritual terms and say it's God's will. Then we get it because it's within his permissive will. It goes south, it goes sour, it turns bad, and then we blame God for the outcome. There's a psalm. Remember when the Israelites were in the wilderness and they were running around and they were hungry and they were complaining about the provision of the manna. They were getting tired of it. You know, manna in the morning, manna in the evening, manna at supper time, and they were just tired of it. And so they said, give us some meat. You know, we want to chew on some meat. And so God sent these quail, and they were just, you know, right about strike zone height, you know. And so the people were whacking the quail. They ate it until it was coming out of their nostrils. I mean, that's a lot of quailage, you know. They got sick of it. And there's a Psalm 106 tells the story. It's kind of commemorating that. And in Psalm 106:15, it says, he gave them their request, but sent leanness to their soul. He gave them what they wanted. They thought that would make them full, but it ended up leaving them empty. I think about that passage often. He gave them their request and sent leanness to their soul. Which would you prefer? You know, when we think of the thing that I want, what I would want to have from God right now that might be within his permissive will, not necessarily his perfect will, not what he would really want from me, but he would allow it to me because, you know, I got freedom in Christ. And so I want this thing from him. And if he would give it to me, but the result would be leanness to my soul, would I take it? It wouldn't necessarily mean I was going to hell. Wouldn't mean that I lost my salvation. Wouldn't mean that I wasn't his child anymore. I'd still go to heaven when I died, but I would have leanness to my soul here on earth. Would I take it? I don't know that those Israelites in the wilderness, because they cried out for quail, were on their way to hell because God gave it to them. I don't think it's a matter of salvation we're talking about here. It's a matter of the fullness of my soul here on earth. It's easy for us to, because we know the right answer. Oh, I'd take, give me the full soul. I don't care. I don't need that stuff here on earth. Just give me that full soul, Lord. I mean, we know that's the right answer, but is that what we would really choose? Would we rather have a full belly over a full soul? Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. And they said, no, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like the nations, like all the nations, that our king may judge us and that we would go out for us and fight our battles. You know, they were kind of blaming their poor military accomplishments on their, you know, the weak political or military organization. rather than spiritual apostasy. They were just thinking if we had a good military leader, you know, as a king, then we would do better against the Philistines, rather than seeing that it was the Lord who fought the battle. So Samuel heard all the words of the people and repeated it in the hearing of the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, heed their voice and make them a king. So Samuel told everybody to go on home. And next week we'll see when they find that king. Let's pray. Father, as we come before you this evening and we bow down, we thank you for your sovereignty in our lives. We thank you that your plans for us are good and not evil. That you have a plan for us, that you have a desire to work in our lives, to bring you glory, to bring us fullness, that it's a good plan. And it's not just simply one for today or tomorrow or for this life, but it's one that will have everlasting ramifications. And your thoughts for us are always good. But our flesh gets in the way of that. We long, we want, we lust for the things that are only of this world and things that hinder us in our growth for you. Our growth towards you. And so, God, we confess that. We repent of it. May you fill us, Lord. May you guide us and teach us in your ways that we could forsake the ways of the world and press on to that upward call. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.